We are at a slightly safer size, but I would remind you that there are no windows and no ventilation improvements. In theory, the cap of occupancy here is 66 of you plus one of me. It is at any time possible for you to decide that you wish to follow this course from elsewhere. As I have told you, you can do that. May I see a show of hands? Everybody's hand should be up who has registered in the wiki. Good. If you didn't have your hand up, you have 24 hours to register in the wiki, after which registration will be closed. And if you want to pass the course, you'll have to ask me to help you register. And I will be happy to do that, but you'll wish you had registered first. Everything is there, as you know. Questions from last time, things you meant to ask but didn't, things you thought of since then that you would like to ask now. Nobody had anything to write in the wiki either, but if you have questions, you should either ask them here or you should make a new topic in the wiki and ask a question and let other people see the answer, or you should send email to moglen@columbia.edu and ask me the question and we won't publicize it. Remember that everything we talk about has three sides to it, a technology part, a law part, and a politics part. The part which is about law, people will be argumentative and self-assertive about because this is law school. The part which is politics will be treated politically, I suppose. The part that is technical will, for some people, make it useful to ask simple technical questions because you don't happen to know the answers to them. Every simple technical question you have a question about, somebody else in the room has a question about too, and they haven't asked it yet. So you will be helping everybody learn when you ask simple technical questions, of which I have assured you in advance there is no reason to be ashamed, right? So I will explain technical material as I think it would be helpful to do it, but I will be wrong. Because after half a century with computers, there's stuff I take for granted that I shouldn't take for granted. And you will help to improve everybody's course if you ask the simple technical questions that occur to you. And nobody will be benefited, including you, if you don't ask them. So that would be my recommendation, strong recommendation. So far, so good. Let me restate the fundamental point about everything we do, which I stated for the first time, but I fear not for the last time. We have built, in your lifetime, if you are the average age of the people in this room, starting slightly before your lifetime, we have built an extraskeletal nervous system which will wrap itself around every human being on this planet in the remainder of your lifetime, such that in your lifetime, children will be born who will live their entire lives from birth until death in the immediate presence of the nervous system we call the net, which will shape every human mind. That nervous system, whose anatomy and physiology we are going to be studying from a technical, legal, and political point of view, is in itself, though it is not determinative of how it is used, determinative of a permanent, irreversible change in the human species. Since 5 million years ago or so, when we parted company with our chimp and bonobo cousins, and the various hominins have been roaming the earth, for the last 5 million years, we have been developing a unique biological entity, the human mind, inside an intraskeletal nervous system closely related to the nervous systems of our immediate primate cousins, but distinctively different. Now we are entering into a period in which, in your lifetimes, that species, the human race, which has developed that mind in connection with its own interior nervous system, and which in the last 500,000 years only, the merest blink in the period of human life, in the last 500 years only began to cultivate an idea about the nature and purpose of that human mind, that it was to develop an independent human being, an identity, a personality, a soul, unique to itself and related to all the other human beings and to whatever concept of the divine was present in each local part of human society, on the basis of the internal process of reading, listening, thinking, expressing, and occasionally making public, in the sense of speaking about or even writing about, the ideas that gave birth to that independent human being. In a few parts of the world, that culminated in ideas of human perfectibility and freedom, including the freedom of thought. Nowhere were those ideas ever fully triumphant. And in your lifetime, they will become functionally obsolete, to be replaced by a different understanding of what it means to be human, such that two generations from now, in the generation of your grandchildren, there will no longer be any living human beings who know what it was like to be human before the net. What they will know, what they will understand, what they will grasp as what it means to be a human being, what is the purpose of human thought, what is the nature of an individual human life, what the political and social values are that are for them inextricably associated with what it means to be human, will no longer be determined only by what their own internal, nervous, neuropsychological, and intellectual processes are. It will be determined also by the physiology of the net, which is our subject. From my point of view, the subject of a lifetime's work also as a lawyer. I made software. I thought about human history. I taught people how to be lawyers in this wonderful institution. And to the extent that I was working myself, doing what it was that I thought my education had equipped me to do other than to teach, it was spent trying to assure that in this world, eminently foreseeable for those of us who were fortunate enough to be the kids making the thing 30 or 40 years ago, as I was, in this world, in which human beings would develop as a superorganism, connected, all of them, by a system of pervasive interconnection functioning as the species-wide nervous system of the race, in that world, I wanted there to be freedom. Freedom, that is, the kind of freedom that we in the world before the net enjoy. This course is about which parts of that effort succeeded, which parts failed, and what you have before you, if you choose to do this particular work, as the human race modifies itself around you, altering everything, including the very nature and purpose of human thought. I said that last week, now I have said it again this week. As I say, I shall regrettably be tedious and say it more times, as we come maybe to understand more of what I mean by it. But that's the subject. The legal, technological, and political ways of understanding what is happening to human beings as we modify ourselves collectively and irreversibly by these means. Question? Huh. Either nobody takes it seriously, or it's already happened, and the purpose of human thought has irrevocably changed, or I have not expressed myself well, because you would think there would be questions. Nobody ever told you that before. Yeah.
You mentioned last week.
Don't bother, because nobody is listening. I am not allowing microphones to lead to recorders in this room. The only people who need to hear you are the people around you. I will repeat questions for the only recorder which is here. That's the only way of assuring that your learning is not surveilled, which from my point of view is really fucking important. Go ahead, please.
You mentioned last week some of the lack of of freedom of thought coming from the potential of influence from advertising and tracking on the net, and you, but you also mentioned your freedom 100% from that advertising in your network, in your internet experience. And I'm wondering how you accomplish that, and if that's something you just avoid ad serving.
Aside from one terribly important technical facility, it was my intention to teach you, which the university CUIT is disabled on the 25th of August, and which we're now fighting about my ability to teach you. Everything that I think is the simple, ready-to-eat, take-it-in-the-box lunch and shove it under your mask version of the question you just asked, I will teach you in the course of this course. And if you take the other one in the spring, I will teach it to you again and concentrate on the question of how to keep the governments out of your business. The short answer to your question is it's not really all that hard. You just have to do things a little differently. Though I will admit that there's no smart answer. And if you are determined to carry a spy satellite aimed at you all the time, if you are determined to make it easy for that spy satellite to spy on you, I find it hard to make it hard for it not to spy on you. So that's the one place where we will differ. In my world, to use computers like that's a really bad idea. It's a really bad idea in the same way that it would have been a really bad idea in the Moscow I lived in 1979 to hold your social events at KGB headquarters. Okay? It's as dumb as that, from my opinion. But that's the only way in which you and I are fundamentally different. Well, not quite. I mean, there's also that ring of power move by King of the Young that I did that I wouldn't touch. Choices of hardware at the margins make a difference. Choices of software make all the difference, because the physiology of the net is determined by its software. The conclusion is probably I use slightly different software than you do, and I probably use it in a slightly different way. But it doesn't make a whole lot of difference in order to eliminate most of the physiological contact between me and the parasite with the mind of God. It does mean that my habits are a little different than yours. I have no Google account. I have no Facebook account. I have no Twitter account. I don't consume services that are offered to me on the basis of tell us everything about yourself and we'll give you trivial email or download and bullshit, right? I produce those services for myself and others, and I consume them in ways that don't involve allowing people to know what the fuck I'm up to. It would not occur to me to locate my music library at Spotify so that somebody spies on everything I hear all the time in my ear. That wouldn't make a lot of sense. I would not like to have a book reader whose job it is to offer me books and watch me read them. That doesn't mean I don't have a book reader or that I don't have music. It means that the software is there. The consequence of which is that who makes the services I am consuming and who produces the services I am offering to other people and where we meet one another, whoever we are when we are meeting me, whether in your case it is how the curriculum is delivered to you through a wiki, or how, if we are having a video call during office hours, the server belongs to me instead of to Zoom and has no Chinese Ministry of State Security in it, I will promise. And nobody is keeping track of the content of that conversation. Or whether it's just the fact that my browser doesn't allow ads. Allow, right? The browser would, it's Firefox, it would allow me to be an idiot, but it doesn't require me. And AdBlock Plus isn't perfect, but it's pretty good. And pre-boxy behind that is pretty good. And a little bit of SSH proxying magic so that no computer downstream from me knows where I was browsing from. And poof, Bob's your uncle. I live in a clean net. I can teach you how to do all those things. But right now, the more important thing is that I can teach you how to think about why a person might need to do that. Because it's less important that you use my plumbing than that you understand why I might be doing that and why you might want to be doing that too. And if you happen to be in Kabul this month or Hong Kong next month, I don't know. Is that responsive? Yes.
Yeah, I'm just curious about the distinguishing the plumbing that you've set up for yourself that keeps out surveillance, but the actual, I mean, you're saying you're still engaging in these behaviors. You're listening.
Which behaviors?
you're listening to music.
Yes, I'm listening to music, I'm watching video, I'm reading newspapers, I'm communicating with human beings, I'm sharing highly classified information with people who have no right to it in the U.S. law, whatever it is I'm doing.
Right, you're engaging in the same behaviors.
I'm not engaging in the same behaviors.
Yeah, right.
Once you recognize that if you're behaving for the engagement machine, if you're behaving for the delectation of the parasite of the mind of God, the purpose of your behavior is changed. Right? So it turns out that the purpose of the behavior changes because the way the services work, the way the computers operate has changed. It's neither thin nor thick, it's both simultaneously.
My question is about like how you secure the plumbing or your system from the tendency of
since 2013, when I gave the Snowden lectures, actually from the spring before the Snowden lectures, I am two hops from a man that the United States government considers it to be perfectly fair play to listen to extensively everybody who was in three hops of him. Right? My problem, if you want to talk about threat model, which is the way to talk about all cybersecurity questions, protection in every sense in this world is relative to some threat model or other. Who are you afraid of? What are you trying to keep out? My threat model, by definition, is active listening by national means of intelligence. That is, state-supported activities willing to break things in order to know what's going on, all right? By definition. My particular understanding of that arises from the fact that this is the second time in my life when that has been true. And later we'll come back to what things were like for me in the early 1990s. But let's just concentrate on the moment that told the story best for me, which is mostly the other course's story, but like that. In June of 2013, I was on my way to give a talk in Edinburgh. And I got a message from friends of mine who live in the WikiLeaks in the Wikipedia universe of Holland. And the message was, there's a young man traveling, and when he gets to Reykjavik, he'd like to see him. Okay, I thought, that's fine. So in addition to the trip I had scoped out to Edinburgh and home, well, okay, to Edinburgh and Amsterdam, I bought a ticket to Iceland. As it turned out, the young man traveling never made it to Reykjavik. His voyage ended in Moscow, as you know. And so I threw away the airplane ticket to Iceland, and I followed my original planned itinerary. I went to my place in Amsterdam and stayed a few days. I went to Brussels to give testimony before the European Parliament, and I came home. Arriving back in my country on the 10th of July of 2013. And I came to the barrier, and I handed my passport, and the guy read the screen for 1 minute and 17 seconds, which was a record. And he turns to me from the screen, and he says, where were you on this trip? And I said, like it says on the card, Scotland, Netherlands, Belgium. He said, not Iceland? No, I said, I bought a ticket, but I didn't go. Welcome home. That was the first demonstration that I was back in a world I knew something about from a long time before, when the technology was a whole lot easier to stay out of the way of. Okay? From that moment, from the cab ride in, from JFK to here, I was in a place where my job was to keep people out who are very good. Best team in the world. I don't succeed. If you ask me, how do I keep them out, I will tell you, well, if the threat model is 12-year-olds in Petersburg, it's all taken care of. If the threat model is acid listening by everybody on Earth, I've got it taken care of. If the threat model is industrial espionage, people trying to climb inside my law firm, I've got it taken care of. Me and the other person with whom I deal with the law practices technology. If you ask me, how do you avoid active listening by natural means of intelligence, the answer is you don't. One day you make a mistake, and every mistake is fatal. All I can do is make them sweat. Some years ago, I was talking about this particular problem to a man whose business is thinking about this particular problem, one of the best I know. And he said to me, well, you may know more about this than I do, which is code in our little industry, for I'm going to tell you something that I think you don't know. Well, he said, you may know more about this than I do, but I think that the guy at Tailored Access Operations who said to me, there is nothing we have ever wanted to get into that we didn't get into, we didn't sure was telling the truth. Tailored Access Operations was then the name for the part of NSA which doesn't do simple key sealing, but which actually does heavy lifting. Tailored Access Operations is retail entry into computer networks to find things that are there that the United States government wishes to know. That the name has been changed, as all such names change rapidly in the intelligence community. His statement was true, I thought. I agreed with him. Yes, I said. I think TAO is ultimately perfectly efficient, but it doesn't scale. Yes, he said, it doesn't scale. That's the only way. In the end, if you are up against the best teams in the world, they win. Because one day, no matter how good you are, you make a mistake. And their business is to take advantage of every single mistake. On the other hand, merely making them do it retail changes everything. Because the mere fact that we are making people do it retail returns us to the other world, about which we will talk much more intensively in January if you're taking the other course. But the basics of it are simple. Mass surveillance is not the same as it. The ability to take everything because you're working hand in glove with the parasite of the mind of God, because you have converted the physiology of the network to your assistance, is entirely different from I have one and you have one and he tries to beat me and I try not to be beaten by him. Once it is retail, it's a game of skill. So long as it is wholesale, it's not even a game of chance. The second most powerful government on earth is absolutely, candidly, completely, and certainly committed to extirpating what I call freedom using the ability to conduct mass surveillance and produce big data despotism. I don't have to ask, they tell us. They're the second best team in the world, and demographically speaking, far and away the first. Our people, the best team in the world, are beginning to cope with the fact that in the end, if the other guy has five times as many people as you do, he tends to win. Same problem. Force it wholesale. You want to use Zoom? Oh man, what make our lives easy? You want to carry smart fucking phones? Make our lives easy. But if what you want to do is make it hard, you can make it. You can beat everything except the best teams in the world. You need tradecraft and you need discipline. It's not complicated, not in that sense. And everything that is embodied in the idea of tradecraft and discipline is just technology, not the technology you happen to use, but equally strong technology is equally good and just different. Is that responsible? You want to follow up? It's not a privilege, it's just a skill.
Yeah, but people might not have...
That's fine. Then it's not a matter of privilege, it's a matter of education. I can teach you.
But the problem is when people have their daily lives to go about, because it's also a matter of just skill. I mean, everyone in class might...
It would be easier to teach you if you were 12 years old, because you would be less busy. This is true. But privacy is within everybody's reach, including yours. It's not a matter of privilege, it's just a matter of access.
But when people do not have the access, and the
large majority of people do not have the access. No, wait. I think we're not understanding one another because we're having a disagreement about the difference between what people can be empowered to do equally and the fact that people are unequally empowered. Because I'm a teacher, I see that distinction as really important. I don't think people are prevented from anything that I know they can learn. Freedom does, in fact, involve learning. Always did. The people of freedom of thought have never been the guys with the easy road. To think of it as privilege is certainly feasible, but I wouldn't say it that way. Because for the last 1,000 years, my comrades have had the privilege of dying for it. Because the struggle's actually been harder than it is now. Because if what you want is to preserve freedom in the 21st century, it's easier than preserving freedom in the 18th. So I think all we're really disagreeing about is some relative understanding about where we are with respect to baseline. Freedom Box as a project was designed so that I could say in India, as I did, if you can afford a home of any kind, you can afford first-class privacy for that home. My goal is certainly to diminish privilege and to increase freedom. On the traditional political basis in my corner of the world, the freedom is merely privilege extended and less enjoyed by one and all. So I'm not interested in stuff that can't be enjoyed by one and all. I agree with you, that would be privilege. This is freedom. Is that helpful? Is that responsive? Or am I missing?
So I'm just thinking, so let's take the case of India, where when you had Aadhaar come in, when people had to get basic ration, they just had to get rice and oil, you had to sign your privacy away.
Yes, if you follow what my comrades in SFL Sudayan do in India with respect to Aadhaar, we fight. Okay? Yes. Between Nandan Nilekani and Narendra Modi, there has been a desire to provide also big digital despotism for the other 1.3 billion people who are relevant. Hence, India is so important. That's the fourth corner of the human race, and what happens there will determine what happens to everybody else. So, I'm with you that this is an important place. Why did we say it takes a freedom box to raise a building? What were all those sweatshirt people doing in AP and in Telangana, except that, trying to prove this point, that for people who want to go about their daily business, everything from buying vegetables to knowing what the weather forecast is, to watching television, it would be a really good idea if we retrofitted the net with privacy. And my partner is in Delhi at the moment preparing a petition in the Supreme Court to challenge NatGrid and CMS, as well as the new IT rules, because we think it's really important. So I'm going to agree with you completely about the significance of this. And I'm not going to agree with a social worker that we were talking to in Hyderabad a few years back, who said, why are you bothering with this freedom box? You give people programs and computers like that, all they're going to do is pornography and games. But I understood the point. And so do you. People are going to do with technology what they want. We're not going to force people. We're going to enable people to be free. And the people who are going to risk their lives aren't the people who are too busy. I agree with you. At subsistence, if we're going to provide people freedom, we're going to have to make it possible along with the struggle for subsistence. Okay. That's the challenge. I'm not going to do the work of the sweatshirt organizers. And they're not going to do mine. But together, we might be able to produce freedom for an awful lot of people. And if we assume that over here in this corner is the current Chinese Communist Party, PRC, dedicated to the removal of freedom, and if we assume over here is American high big data capitalism doing the job of knowing about every roll of toilet paper that everybody uses, and if we assume that the Europeans are going to be sitting in Brussels crying in their beer and making wonderful regulations that cost more to enforce than any society other than their own could possibly afford, and trying to regulate technologies they need to create or control, then what happens in India is really going to matter. Because 1.4 billion people are going to be living under the rule of the Chinese Communist Party for the foreseeable future. And if 1.2 billion Indian people are also living in digital despotism, that will turn out to be a third of the human race and too much for us to overcome in the other two-thirds, crippled as we are, with surveillance capitalism and European Donbas regulation. So India must be a place of freedom and democracy. That will affect this whole process we are talking about. everything you have to say about what that means in dealing with a country in which people are poor. And if we're not talking about Carol, also are not literate. That's a heavy lift. A bigger problem, I admit, than keeping NSA out of my system. But the same is true. Every single mistake will be capitalized upon remorseless. So we better do it right. So you and I have a few weeks in which to figure out what we know about that and to pool our understanding. Is that responsible? Other people? Yes?
I was wondering whether there was a way to measure objectivity in the loss of individual freedom of choice.
How would you produce a number?
Not necessarily a number, but...
Okay, when I was your age, 100% of my reading was never surveilled.
Yeah.
Now you are my age, and then... And something closer to 9/10 of everything you read is surveilled.
Yeah.
Is that a sufficient metric, or should we get more precise?
But does that translate in a measurable metric for the loss in freedom of thought?
Yes, because in the Soviet Union, where that was true, there was less than there was in the United States when I was young.
Yeah.
You want to believe it doesn't, that in all of your reading can be surveilled and you still have freedom of thought. This was a question that came up last week, too.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Is it really the case that privacy is necessary for freedom of thought? It's a good question. I answered yes. Are you asking me how we measure my answer? I've tried to suggest. But that still brings us back to the idea that you could live in a world in which everything you read was watched by somebody else and have freedom of thought. I denied it. I tried to explain why I denied that, but my explanation may not have been any good. Can we try it the other way just for a change? Can you explain to me how it is possible to have freedom of thought if everything you read is surveilled? What seems obvious to me is not obvious. I warrant you that. I think that's just first order basic. If I put myself back at the beginning of my undergraduate career, hi, Evan, welcome to Swarthmore. We will look over your shoulder at everything you read. You will never, ever, ever read unsurveilled again. The 17-year-old me would have walked out. Seemed obvious to me. But then I knew where the bones of my family were. In a trench, in Minsk. Nice brains, pulled apart by machine gun bullets in the summer of 1940. Because I knew what it was like to walk down the street in Leningrad at 2 a.m. with the sound of KGB footsteps behind me. So maybe what seems obvious to me is no longer obvious. I have a 20th century idea in a 21st century world. Maybe I'm wrong. Why am I wrong? Help me to understand why it is now possible to have freedom of thought in the presence of the concrete, comprehensive, unending and unforgetting surveillance of everything you need. Yeah?
Well, I think, just to reformulate the question I was asking earlier, I think when I meant security, I meant from like when I try to access a library to get information, I imagine that the library is keeping statistics about the number of times a book title or an author is searched, maybe for their own purposes to decide whether books are kept in Butler or if kept in an off-site location.
You're imagining a much more efficient organization than exists.
Sorry, say again?
You're imagining a much more efficient organization than
I'm
exists.
I'm optimistic.
Google Books, the Universal Library of KGB, the Universal KGB Library of Menlo Park does that.
Right.
But Columbia does not do that. And knowing which is which and how to do things that are useful to you while setting off as little of that as possible is the trigger. And about this, there will be privilege. But then access to the university library is privilege.
Sure.
So, right, yes, I do things, yes, I do things designed to minimize that too.
Okay.
And those two are teachable things. And once again, they are not perfect, but it doesn't have to be perfect. Once you are barely there, you are not there. Hence, we build airplanes, which, I mean, radar still sees them, sort of. But below the threshold, where it really helps the guy with the anti-aircraft gun, that's what we want you to be able to do. want you to make no unnecessary lifelong stupid mistakes. We want you to be aware of what is happening, to have situational awareness, which is necessary when KGB footsteps are following you and doing more than that. And we want your habits to be habits of hygiene rather than habits of mistake. If you spend two generations pulling Russians out of their homes in the middle of the night and sending them to Siberia or shooting them, they will become careful. The Americans I grew up with were just about the only people on Earth who felt it was okay to say whatever you wanted to say on the telephone. Almost nobody else did. That was a privilege of American freedom in the period of the smooth day of the empire. After that, you get more careful. If I teach you how to encrypt your email, you should encrypt the email you don't want people to read. Otherwise, you spend the rest of your life sending postcards. If I show you how to throw your browsing from here to there with an encrypted tunnel in between so that nobody between here and there can know what you're doing, and everybody downstream from there thinks you're over there, that will do some things. It won't do everything. But if Columbia goes and breaks your ability to do that on the universally available Columbia computers, so that in order to do that you'd have to have a server inside the wire, which I can do, that's brutal. Then I have to go and fight with them over restoring your ability to do on their computers the same thing that I can do on mine. And once again, we're not making it perfect, but we're making it better. And if I ask myself, if I have to live the rest of my life by Moscow rules, what can I do? The answer is I can do more things than you can, because if we have to play by Moscow rules and you do the wrong thing, you're gone. The world is more dangerous. You have no rules. And what you do affects the freedom of your grandchildren. Those are three independent propositions, but I believe all of them. Yes?
Sir, in response to mass surveillance, we're advocating for more privacy. So are we referring to absolute privacy, or would you say...
I just heard you saying that it's never going to be absolute. It's only going to be better. Does that answer, or am I answering the wrong question?
No, it's the right.
Perfection is not attainable for you. As long as you're going to carry a smart ass phone, perfection isn't even approachable. But it could be. Yes?
I have a question from the stance of the self-runners. If the point is that the free software movement is like the achieving goal for the public policy, like all the profit that comes from collecting human behavior will be reduced. What would be like the stance for them to run software? Because they are not collecting anything, they are not profiting from anything, and I understand that...
No, wait, I'm not sure I understand the question. It is true. If we decide to make behavior harder to collect, whether we do that technically, or we do that legally, or we do that as a consequence of political authority exercised in democratic ways, we will change these businesses. It's kind of like asking, what will we do if we require 60% of the remaining fossil fuel reserves to be left in the ground? Okay, so we agree, up to that point. Now, what is the next part?
No, that's not the point. I don't want to tell you, how can they profit? They're not
profiting. I'm sorry, I don't understand. I'm not worried about their profit. I'm worried about freedom. Must I also worry about their profit? Is that, too, part of my responsibility or yours? If you want to make sure that ExxonMobil is going to continue to be exactly as rich as it is now, why are you going to do that? Because you think that unless they are insured their money, you can't do what you want to do to save the climate? Or because of some general principle of universal benevolence, I want everything to be Pareto superior all the time, nobody ever loses? Or because you feel particularly charitable about them? Having said in 2009 that Mark Zuckerberg had done more harm to the human race than everybody else's age, I realized and noticed that I'm not looking out for his profit. Yeah, the big politics involves winners and losers. I'm trying to make the freedom of thought the winner and the people opposing it the loser. They are trying to reverse. For most of the last 1,000 years, they won every single time, and most of the people who were in my position wound up dead. That will happen too this time, perhaps, or perhaps it won't. But their profit, that's not my concern. If you want to sign up for their concern, that's okay, I'll help you. This is law school. You have a right to work for the evil people. An absolute right. But I'll work for you. Yes, that was a hand. I don't. Yes, thank you.
Is it possible to achieve freedom through regulation?
From?
Regulation and state legislation.
Sure, it's possible to achieve it a little bit, but you'd have to have a very efficient government that always wrote the right regulations, was completely incorruptible, and was absolutely backed by the rule of law. There's no place on earth that that occurs. That's possible. I know people in the European Commission Legal Service who believe they're going to get there the day after tomorrow or next week. It's their right to believe that, but I don't proceed on that belief. Why would it help you if that were true? Then all we would have to do would be politics, and they would do law, and we would have a simpler life, right? Because we could analyze more easily. Is there another reason why we would prefer the regulation were the solution? But I'm not sure that that's true. I used to have students in this class who were really interested in Brazilian internet regulation. I'm sure they're not really interested in it. Maybe after the next election, they'll be interested. Right now, their interest should be preventing despotism, correct? Regulation won't prevent despotism. That's the trick that the clown there in Bolsonaro wishes to prove on the way out the door.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, if you need to spread a message and make it understandable to the vastest amount of people you can imagine...
I should use regulation for that?
Well, there is either the law or the media, but the media is like kind of...
No, no, I mean, in the end, wouldn't it be better to make a freedom box and teach every 12-year-old for herself? Regulation is a very powerful, extremely narrow, very corruptible instrument. It has great uses. The minute you think you can stand holding on that leg, the stool falls over. And please remember that the guy on the other side, running the second largest and most powerful society on earth, almost as large as India and almost as powerful as we, also has regulation. And if you're concerned about the profits of the people who harness the parasite of the mind of God for their profit, the regulations of the PRC are very important. Because regulation operating in the interest of evil is very powerful too. So I really do want to say, I won't say insist, I will only say I want to say that every single facet of what we do must be approached on three roads. And every attempt to say, well, we can leave the other two roads aside, let us do just this or let us do just that, let us just have socialism in our lifetimes, or let us just have perfect internet regulation, or let us just let technology solve every problem, each of those equally reductive and in the end equally unpromising. The hard problem is the one we have to solve. Three bodies in motion. And we won't be able to take a shortcut and say, oh, the regulator, he will fix it. He will not. Nor will the tech billionaire. Nor will the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. If indeed we wish to retain for your grandchildren what your grandparents had, we have a tough problem to solve, and we need to solve every individual facet of it. Technological, political, and legal. That's the position I am proposing here. I am always eager to work through it. And if anybody can provide a real reason for me to believe that at least one third of what I've been doing for the last six decades is not important anymore, I will take that news gratefully and die happy. Because I think I am handing along a problem just as bad as the problem I got. I don't think it's got the same.
But then I just want to confirm that I understood correctly that you think that the way to ensure more privacy for everyone is to teach people to be in charge of their own privacy.
That's one good thing to do.
But Is it like exclusively the best way?
No, no, but again, I'm going to say, we're never going to settle on a way.
Yeah, I heard that, but I mean, you discredited the regulation.
I didn't discredit it, I expressed its limitations.
Clearly.
And the limitations of teaching every 12-year-old how to run a freedom bus are also very severe.
Exactly.
As are the limitations of believing that we're going to have democracy through struggle. But we're going to do all three of them. None of them is perfect. None of them is the one. None of them is the best. They're all parts of something we are struggling to learn about, to understand broadly. So that unlike other people, we're not caught believing in the one true answer. Look at this lawsuit. In 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, it's entirely possible we can't be here anymore. I would say the odds that we can complete a school year in the following not-so-perfect form are about 50-50. The problem for the rest of the people in this building is that they have only two choices, this or Zoom school. Zoom school won't work. They had a year to prove that. They succeeded in getting one full year of full tuition out of people for Zoom school, which is completely broken. If they try and do it again to you, you won't pay full price for it. But they have no alternative, this or Zoom school. Why? Not because technology won't allow them to teach in a resilient fashion, but because they never tried to solve the problem. And even now, 18 months into the epidemic, they refuse to address the problem. I don't have to worry about this because 7 years ago I started solving the problem. My solution isn't perfect, but if we all need to stop meeting here, I can still teach you. And I can do it in a way that won't rot your brain neurophysiologically the way Zoom did. I can't make it perfect, but I can make it better. If they knew how, they wouldn't have to pretend that people aren't getting sick. But they will have to pretend. Right up until the moment when they can't pretend it anymore and they shut down again. Yes?
I was wondering, since you figured out a way to do it, did you pitch it to the university?
No, of course not. My concern is my students. Why would I pitch it to people who tell me that coursework will never go away? I'm not going to spend the rest of my life struggling over the defects of my contemporary. I have a few hundred weeks left on Earth. I choose instead to teach you. But if I were you, I might feel completely different. By the time we're done, you'll know everything I know about this. You can go and struggle with it. If you like, I'll tell you what I think. I think you'll lose. Not just because they don't really care about resilient teaching, but because the university needs the parasite. Their overwhelming addiction to Canvas inside coursework isn't there because they're stupid. They are stupid. But they had Sakai. Coursework was based on a free software, non-surveilling platform for curricular delivery. They don't want it. They want the ability to surveil your learning. Let's just spend one tiny little moment on this highly defective form of low-quality commodity video conferencing called Zoom. Let us roll back in our minds to where it was before the beginning of the epidemic. Zoom was then a business video conferencing system. Zoom marketed itself primarily as a thing that allowed prepared business meetings in multiple locations to proceed by video conferencing. This, unlike teaching law school to commodity endpoints, running lousy little video conferencing software, is a good business. For that, video conferencing has a purpose. Prepared locations, on business networks, secure infrastructure, being used to provide for organizations to conduct hierarchically structured meetings. It wasn't bad. I still had no use for it, but it wasn't bad. And Zoom had this one aspect which made people interested. It was basically a marketing throwaway. Because the way Zoom structured its web presence, you could give somebody a URL and they could join a Zoom conference without an account or any authentication. And because Zoom had this one little convenient element, which wasn't really in their business, but it was an attractive, shiny thing, little feature for getting acquainted. Because they made it easy to join just by clicking on a URL in an email message. When the world went into epidemic tizzy, everybody knew they could just hop on Zoom. Because the Zoom infrastructure didn't require all that accounting. But that's not the way the universities used it. That's not the way this university used it. They went and they handed them wheelbarrows full of money for Zoom Pro, which required you to have an account and log in. Why did they do that? If the point was to have a reasonably privacy-reinforcing form of video conferencing for emergency resilience in education, why did they pick the KGB version? Well, you know the answer, because attendance was taken that way. Because you had to be noticeable, because whether you were there or not had to be provable, because Zoom did it for you. Also made things very much easier for the Chinese Ministry of State Security. It's important to understand that the parasite is in active collaboration with a large part of the human race, which finds being in collaboration with the parasite very profitable. If I'm going to disturb the relationship with the parasite and kill it entirely, I'm going to hurt their business. I feel so bad. I need a great big organdy gown that says, screw the rich in the back. So you don't know which side. Okay, I don't care about their profit. I don't care about their ability to surveil your learning. It would never occur to me to call a thing hybrid education, in which you come into the classroom and you log on to Zoom while you're in the classroom. But that was part of the absurdity of last year. And if the bounce in the infield is bad, it will be part of the absurdity around here 6 weeks from now. That's what I mean when I say that the physiology of the network determines the nature of human thought. I thought I knew when I was, let us say, 16 in 1975, working on the first networked email server I'd ever heard of. I knew which side I was on. I thought the guys in Moscow were on the other side. In the winter of 1978, as an American Yanny gun, I found myself going from time to time to the place that the Russians call, in their jargon of the Soviet era, the right place. People didn't say KGB, they said the right place. And every once in a while, I found myself in the right place. And in the right place, in Leningrad, in 1978, I met a lot of little rat-faced men. I do not actually know whether one of those little rat-faced men was Vladimir Putin. He was one of the little rat-faced men working in the right place in Leningrad in the winter of 1978. I just don't know whether I had the good luck to meet him. But if I didn't meet him, I met a lot of people like him. I thought I knew who was on our side. I really did. In the course of doing something in the Soviet Union that I wasn't supposed to do, I went and reinsured with a spy in the American Embassy in Moscow, a fine cultural attaché. Because I had no intention of telling people at home what I was going to do, because that would have been listened to. And if something happened to me, and despite my then 20-year-old assumption that nothing bad could ever happen to me, if something bad happened to me, I did want for there to be one person in the official American community who knew where I was going and what I was doing and which stolen papers I was doing it with. Then we were on the same side. By 2014, he and I were on the opposite side again. And he was out chasing my comrades. But I thought I knew, because the 20th century had more clarity. Nonetheless, I still know, and I believe you do too. And this course is about what it would be like to have that feeling in the 21st century.
Knowing which side you're on?
Yeah, and knowing what the other side is trying to do. Yes.
Could you maybe give us like a really basic breakdown of why Colombia is interested in surveilling coastwalks and what they get out of it?
Yes, because your behavior has value.
They just
want to
know how we're looking at forces
and what. I will say here what I was saying in the first year class, and forgive me for being repetitive about this. The single most incorrectly used word in law school is just, which almost never has anything to do with justice and always has to do with an artificial reductive constraint. They don't know why they're collecting that information completely. They don't know what is saleable, but something is saleable.
Do you think something is being sold right now?
Well, of course things are being sold right now. Do you want to discuss which ones?
Yeah.
Okay, so beginning last year, spam filtering, which used to be a job done in-house by an excellently highly trained postmaster named Joe Brennan, with whom I have worked for a quarter of a century almost here, spam filtering was delegated to an outside company called Proofpoint. Proofpoint takes hold some of your email for ransom. Right? What is the email that holds for ransom? Not your most valuable mail, not your personal mail, your low priority mail. That is to say, mostly commercial advertising mail directed at you. And why do they hold it captive? So that you will click for them to show which of the commercial email you receive you actually value. Proofpoint is marketing that information to the very people sending commercial mail, who attach value to knowing that you value their mail. In order to make that happen, the university repointed its MX records, for those of you who are DNS junkies, every mail server in every domain in the internet is pointed at by a so-called MX record. The MX record for the mail at Columbia before the epidemic was pointed at a Columbia computer. mail.columbia.edu. After last year, the MX record points directly at Proofpoint. So all the mail coming to any address at columbia.edu is actually first seen by Proofpoint. They get all the traffic. All the traffic. What people are pleased to call metadata. They have all the metadata of all the mail. They had to take captive mail which is low priority to you, but about which your desire to read it is high value to somebody else. In return, they give free spam filtering to Columbia University. Joe Brennan doesn't have to work here anymore. We can lay off some persons, one or two. And somebody else walks away with the information about who everybody at Columbia University is receiving email from. Is that a good example? Okay.
But doesn't it cost more to externalize the service rather than to just hire someone to do it in-house?
I don't know. It depends upon whether you're a bean counter who counts salaries or not. You and I are going to argue that. In fact, I'm going to offer three other arguments. One, it's bad technology. Two, it's unethical. And three, it's illegal. But never mind. If you're asking, does CUIT actually make rational decisions about how to use computing facilities on campus, the answer is no. But that's because they don't know what academic computing is. 10 years ago on this campus, academic computing and administrative computing were separate. Computing done for academic purposes was inside the infrastructure of information services, including libraries, and it had a staff who managed academic computing. Under the wise administration of Lisi Bollinger, academic computing was merged into administrative computing to produce CUIT, an IT organization which would look pretty good in an investment bank or a tire company or a pharmaceutical company. But which doesn't look really good for academic computing. Academic computing consists of people smarter than you are doing things with computers you didn't know were possible. It's never a good idea to give an administrative computing system jurisdiction over stuff being done by people smarter than they are doing things with computers they didn't know were possible. They'll get it wrong every time. They just took over the loss of wireless systems a little too quickly. You don't have to worry about that, of course. I don't even have to worry about that. I am going to worry about that, but I don't have to. But it's just another piece of the tentacles reaching around to undermine the idea of academic computing. One of the themes of academic computing being don't surveil learning. As you change how the politics of computing is done, you're changing the purpose of computing. By changing the purpose of computing, you're changing the nature of human thought. Small, but just in the same way as the larger processes I am describing. It's fractal. At any scale of visualization, I can show you the same phenomena occurring. Generally speaking, during the 2 hours we spend together on Wednesday afternoons, I'm going to pick some zoom quantity, some scale at which to reflect these phenomena. And if you ask me a question, if we go out by half a diopter or we go in by three, will we find the same phenomena there? And then I will say, yes, we'll find the same phenomena there. A feature of the way certain systems work, discovered by a mathematician called Benoit Mandelbrot, who worked at the IBM Research Center in 1973, 2 years before I arrived there. Fractal quality is a quality of many physical systems. What looks like arbitrary complexity is similar phenomena working at different scales. So in these questions, we are pursuing different scales of the same basic underlying idea, which is why I think these questions are productive and important, because they allow you to begin to walk around the phenomena at different sizes. Other questions? You're a lawyer. You figure that out case by case and time by time. That's essentially what lawyering is, isn't it? Figuring out when you can push back and when it won't work and when it will only sort of work for a while and separating the tactical from the strategic. But here's the thing, you know, because you're a lawyer, it's always more possible than people who aren't lawyers think it is. Because that's what you do. That's the highest and most central part of your value to your clients. You know when to push back. You know where. You know how much. You don't lose when you could win. And when you lose in a way which sets up a later win for you in some other context. That's who you are. So you're asking the right question. But we can't know the answer until we get into it. Most businesses think that people will use their devices their way. Of course they do, so do schools. But that's where the learning is. Right? Yeah, all this is easy for me. I have a privilege called tenure. And I have a privilege called I know how. And I have a privilege called I wish to be thought of as dangerous. You have all those privileges too, or at least you could. You can always know how. You can always be safe and secure and much harder to kill than the other people. And you can wish to be dangerous. But that doesn't mean you'll always wish any of those things or that you'll always have them. When you start working as a lawyer, you begin to figure out what you require. If it's your fight, you'll know how to push back. If it's not your fight, it's somebody else's fight, and you don't have to. My job is to make it possible for you to decide that it's your fight. Is that responsible? Yes.
Professor, you mentioned a little bit.
I would prefer to be Evan.
You mentioned a little bit about the GDPR in your talk at the group talk speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that it's just the beginning of the to regulate like a collection of behavior, but
right.
You said that it's not the whole thing.
Not only is it not the the whole thing. It's not even facing in the right direction, but it's a start. GDPR is an example of why regulation is both a really good idea and a really bad one. Right? GDPR represents a good idea. Let us protect the privacy of citizens of the European Union. It's not a good idea because it thinks that that's about consent. Consent is not the proper basis for the regulation. But getting the regulation right doesn't just mean having honorable people doing the work or having information commissioners who know what time of day it is. Right? You also have to have an underlying understanding of how to use power. GDPR is not a good idea because consent is not a good idea. GDPR can be no more useful than consent. Once there is consent, it becomes, well, it's vaccinated. And it doesn't take hold anymore. Consent is not the right idea because we are not engaged in a transaction about privacy. We're engaged in an ecological or an environmental search of privacy. And in environmental law, consent is not the protection against liability or the source of legitimacy. Environmental law cannot exist if you're allowed to say, well, I'll make a $5 payment and subject my children to poisonous air. Environmental regulation depends upon standards which are socially set and which cannot be verified. If you don't have that, you can't regulate the environmental outcomes. All you can do is to delegate those outcomes to individuals who do not have the regulator's perspective, information, or understanding. So if you begin with any structure of regulation in this area, which is based upon consent, you are already guaranteed to achieve not the outcome you were seeking, unless the outcome you were seeking was a simple way of allowing privacy destruction. The result is that in the United States we have, do you want to use these wonderful services? Check yes, and you will never respect your privacy again. And in Europe, we have, do you want to use these wonderful services? If so, check yes, and we will never protect your privacy again. But they're completely different, and indeed they are. The only thing is they're not different in the way that legal realists would care about. If you're a person who believes in things instead of words, and we, the American lawyers, are, then it's important to understand that GDPR is the Tweedledee. And we are the Tweedledum. And we really are very much alike because neither one of us actually thinks ecologically about privacy. It's really hard to think ecologically about privacy. Much more complicated. You want to get something done this decade? Ignore the basics. Voila, GDPR. But it's a step in the right direction. Because ultimately, you could wake up one day and begin repurposing that stuff towards a behavior collection regulation. Data protection is bad. Data protection is always bad. I'm not in the business of protecting data. I'm in the business of protecting people. But data protection is what we get because we're not in the business of protecting people. We're in the business of protecting data business. Play the game our way, and we'll give you a clean bill of health. True in Brussels, true in Washington, true in Beijing. Not true in Room 642. I'm not interested in it. So this is what I meant. Step in the correct direction. We want the right thing. We empower organizations to get the right thing. Not a step in the right direction. We don't use the correct concepts. And in the end, we wind up doing what regulation does best, which is organizing businesses to confront the government. Which doesn't mean the regulation can't do other things, but that it will do. Yes.
It's not everything. It's also about because like data other than collected data, like is it data beyond outside the scope of content, like aggregate data? Is it
like what is aggregate?
I mean, you meant
I took some people and I ground up their bones and I made my bread. That's aggregate data? All those little bones in there? Or do we mean anonymized data? That is, data which is not anonymized but can pretend. Or did we mean useful data that we would really like to have? Like we have, in 2013, we got 1 year of A to B taxi data in New York City, publicly available. That is, the A and the B of every single taxi ride in New York City. No medallion numbers, no identifying information about passengers, okay? Very useful data. Very useful data. Very aggregate. All right. So here are the first two things that started happening. The first thing that started happening was celebrity pictures. Right. Here is George Clooney on Spring Street, getting into a taxi cab. How do we know? Because somebody on the bystander took an iPhone photograph of George Clooney getting into a taxi cab. Okay? And the iPhone was very nice. It told us the date and the time. And we know where it is because we can see. It's on Spring Street. Now, that's an A. So we go to the data, and we look up that A on that time. Oh, now we have the B. Where was George Clooney going? That was aggregate data, but it didn't turn out to be anonymous. It didn't even turn out to be aggregate. It turned out to be excellent data about where George Clooney was going. The second thing that happened was a data hacker, a friend of mine. He says, I have an A in my mind. The A in my mind is the Hustle Club on 12th Avenue on the West Side Highway at the bottom of 54th Street at midnight. Now, why don't I go and ask about all taxi journeys that began at the Hustle Club after midnight on all days? Okay? That's a set of A's. Out falls a set of B's. Some of those B's are workers going home. For stalkers, this is very good. These are strippers being followed home from work by a machine. It's a little dangerous. And some of them are customers. Now, it turns out that if you take all those A's, and you take that A and you look at all the B's, and you subtract all the workers, and you just concentrate on the customers, now what you have is a whole bunch of people going home from the strip club after midnight. And it turns out that many of those addresses have very few people living there. So you turn those around and you say, okay, make that an A prime. Now show me all the journeys from A prime to anywhere. And pretty soon you're beginning to make a little map of all the movements of all the men who happen to leave the Hustler Club after midnight all year long. Ooh, that turns out to be a very interesting data set. Has all kinds of stuff in it. This is why the phrase aggregate data, I respond to it differently than you expect me to, because I think, oh, that aggregate there. Let me get my little hammer and my little chisel, and I will take that concrete apart for you. It will turn out there are many interesting rocks in that concrete. It's not as aggregate as you thought it was. It's never as aggregate as you thought. And if you're the Chinese Communist Party, you don't think of it as aggregate. You think of it as the basis of the behavior prediction of 1.4 billion people. We will meet you on the corner where you are going. KGB liked that. The only thing was that KGB had to follow you to that corner in order to know where it was. Yes?
I have a whole question about the GDPR. You mentioned consent isn't what you phrased as the proper basis of regulation. What would you say is
The adumbration of public environmental standards. It's not different than it is in environmental law. How much mercury should there be in the air?
And how would you regulate that when it comes to data in general?
Why is that hard? What about it is hard for you?
No, I mean, like, it just as a theory.
It's like asking, how do we regulate the discharge of chemicals into the water and the land and the air? It's hard because you need detail. It's hard because it's a moving target. You need a lot of experts, and you need a lot of information flow, and you need the power to knock on the door and open it without being invited. You need a certain number of important capacities, skills, accesses, availabilities. You have to build a system for it. That system is human as well as technological, and it has to have law on its side, and it has to be capable of politically protecting itself. It's not simple in the sense that we could just do it on the back of a matchbox. But it's simple in the sense that it's not that we've never done this before, or that we don't understand that that's the problem, or that in order to continue to live on a habitable world, you're pretty much going to have to do that with every garden at the end of the day, sooner or later, everywhere. You could think of net zero as the GDPR of climate regulation. Right? Some way of making the math unimportant, some way of saying, well, as long as there's a zero down there in the lower right-hand corner, everything's fine, right? Same problem. You have to do the hard work. But it can be done. The concepts, plus the skills, plus the politics, embodying the law, will do some things. And if at the same time we are busy teaching 12-year-olds how to do their part, right? The Austrian and Swiss forms of civil defense are not the same as the American forms of civil defense. Right? When I get on a bus in Israel and there are 16-year-olds carrying M16s on the bus, it's not my favorite thing. But I understand why that might actually be better than having everything done by spec ops. We have to build systems that do what we want. And in order to understand how to do that, we have to think about the technology and the politics and the law. So let us think of this as a planning. I can't plan yet because people don't agree with me about what we're planning. And that may never happen. But if we had consensus about what we're trying to do, then we could be making plans to do it. And in saying that, I say nothing that I didn't say to Paul Nemitz when he was busy being the European Commission's chief lawyer for GDPR. I'm not concealing where I always was. I'm always there. We can do it. We can't do it that way. Okay, so I could use half an hour to do the stuff I meant to do this week that we haven't already done. And basically, that's about political economy. Before we come next week to begin to think about the anatomy of this nervous system, and then we can think about its physiology, now I just want to think for a moment about the metabolism, how it eats. The book, as I said last time, was the first mass-produced article in Western material culture. And it's a shocking and wonderful thing, the book. Mass production through interchangeable parts called movable type, etc., etc. And the book, because it is an article of industrial manufacture, has a cost. Marginal cost is way not zero. It has to be printed, it has to be bound, it has to be moved, it has to be delivered. The political economy of information is now different. For the first time in the evolution of Western culture, those who wish to learn don't have to be moved to those who teach. Though still, because the book is heavy, because the book is not useful all by itself, but mostly in connection with other books, we still wind up with universities, that is, places to which people must come because the books are there. And even though the book is a mass-produced article, therefore making it much cheaper than handmade books, still, it's privilege to have books. And books are themselves an article with a cost. And the person who wishes the book must pay the cost. Thus it was until the 20th century, when the inventions of Thomas Edison began to change the political economy of information. By the end of the first third of the 20th century, we are beginning to experience a new political economy of information structured around radio. Information is distributed free. Wireless transmission means zero marginal cost to the recipient of the copy of music on the radio, or teaching on the radio, or propaganda on the radio. it can be delivered equally, funded by advertisers or by government, one or the other. And we begin to derive two forms of the political economy of information: public goods paid for by the public, and this thing we call profit, which is the use of information for two purposes. And that dual use structure allows the use that the most of the population thinks of as in front to be paid for by what's in back. One part of the hidden subsidy isn't hidden, it's the soap sellers, the advertisers themselves. The other part of the hidden element was the propaganda possibility of radio. Late in the 20th century, before all these other things happened, I wrote once that what we called totalitarianism in the 20th century could quite usefully have been described as monarchism of radio. Monarchism with radio. That was really what totalitarianism turned out to be. In the West, at the pinnacle of this, in the 1930s and 40s, there were four voices on radio that reshaped human understanding at the time. Franklin Roosevelt, and Joseph Stalin, and Adolf Hitler, and for a briefer period of time, Winston Churchill, whom Boris Johnson will never cease to admire. And what they are is monarchs with radio. That means they can put their voice inside the house. Previously impossible in the history of human power, the voice of the leader in the house. Do you remember the old business called the Radio Corporation of America, then to be called the NBC, that the company that in the middle of the 20th century, when RCA Victrola was a leading recording company, had a little thing that went in the center of the vinyl disc, the picture of the dog and the Victrola with the horn? Oh, gee, it's the iconography of the 20th century free world. The Radio Corporation of America, RCA Victrola, the dog looking at the bell of the Victrola, and the motto was his master's voice. There you are. That's the four voices on radio, the masters in the house. Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats. The President of the United States was never able to sit at the fireside of 30 million American households. Now he could. So could Hitler. So could Stalin. That was the other part of the political economy of information. A change in the nature of social control. All right, so then we have television, we have Hollywood, we have all sorts of things, and we bring ourselves near the end of the 20th century, circa 1995, let's say, around the time some people here were born. Now, at this time, there begins another transition, right? In the world, for example, of newspapers. And suddenly, newspapers are free. And everybody can read. Circulation of the New York Times on pieces of dead trees is still about 1.25 million. But on the net, 6.5 million daily by 1997. Oh. So what is happening? Stuff that used to be the valuable thing you bought has become the thing that is given away. My friends in the Soviet Union, as you heard me say in Berlin, had a very important joke about this. The only free cheese is in a mousetrap. It's like Milton Friedman's, there is no free lunch, except that Milton Friedman's, there is no free lunch, is in the passive voice. My Russian friends know that there's a mousetrap, and that means there's a person behind the mousetrap, and you're the mouse. That was an important addition. America is always a little slow on that point. But that was what was happening. That was when Rupert Murdoch thought buying the Wall Street Journal and giving it to people to read for free. Even Rupert Murdoch. Even Rupert Murdoch. Because the alternative to giving people for free is to make them pay for it. And we didn't have good micropayments on the web. Why didn't we have good micropayments on the web? Well, because the United States government restricted the way that encryption could be exported around the world, and you couldn't have a good micropayment system without forms of encryption software that the United States government didn't want people to have. So soon, we'll watch as my comrade David Chaum in Amsterdam invents secure anonymous digital currency in the early 1990s. Now, we could have done it, but we don't do it because we can't export the crypto technology that would be required to do it, because in 1995 in Rasenheim, the American government makes all the Western European Union countries sign up to encryption controls equivalent to its own, and we lose the opportunity to build secure digital cash, and instead, people on the web buy things with their credit card. Now, when you buy things with your credit cards, you have to give your name and your address, and suddenly we're busy spying on people for the first time. So we lose anonymous digital cash. We create non-anonymous payment systems. We give away a lot of stuff because otherwise we'd have to do the credit card overhead and all of that. We don't have frictionless payment systems, but we begin experimenting with how wonderful it is to know who's buying when and exactly what else they were buying. Yes?
A bit lost about why did we have to wait for the person in Amsterdam to make the case, and what was the American government's issue?
Good. So we'll go through all of that in a couple of weeks. And let me just give the short story again. Or you could look at the first Snowden lecture, in which all of this is spelled out in detail. The American government, after the Second World War, tried to control all digital encryption one way or another to prevent the export around the world of codes it couldn't read. Therefore, under the aegis of the statute, the Arms Export Control Act, and its regulatory embodiments, the International Trade in Arms Regulations, known as the ITARs, software engaging in encryption was a munition from the point of view of the American government. And it controlled the movement of munitions around the world as best it could. In the early 1990s, some of us, that's my client Philip R. Zimmerman, and me and some other lawyers, begin attempting to break that system. We are therefore very bad people. We are in favor of pedophilia and nuclear terrorism. And I begin to deal with active listening by national means of intelligence. Over 10 years, we win that. The American government gives up attempting to regulate the kind of encryption embodied in the free software we make, including pretty good privacy and open SSH and all the things which are the remaining technical reasons that you have any privacy at all. In the intervening period, between roughly 1975 and Christmas 1999, there are significant blockages in the world on the export of encryption technology, because the Americans dictate. That has many odd and peripheral consequences, some of which we will study. But the central consequence is we can't do things that require strong encryption that everybody in the world can use, like secure anonymous digital cash.
But that's something which is restricted.
No, now we have cryptocurrency. We're talking about something different. We will talk about that too. That, as Benjamin Applebaum was writing in the New York Times yesterday, is mostly just bright, shiny things that don't make any difference. But if what you're talking about is Bitcoin and its revolutionary function, I will say, you know, what I said to you last week, I know who Satoshi Nakamoto is. We were all there. That's not our attempt to restart now. That's what we invented then that we could have been using if it hadn't been for the fact that we weren't allowed. And what was critical was breaking the regulations, harming the American Empire's ability to read everything on Earth. No, there were other little secondary consequences. Let us take that thing that you no longer believe exists called the DVD. Yeah? You remember the DVD? It was encrypted. That was how Hollywood could say that you could only play it in this part of the world this week, and you couldn't make a copy of it. You know, that's But the DVD CSS, that is the content scrambling system, that is the encryption on the DVD, had to be exportable. And all of that engineering was done during the period I'm talking about, in the early 1980s. And even inside a company like IBM, it couldn't be done because the Japanese part of IBM and the American part of IBM couldn't exchange encryption unless it was weak. And so the DVD encryption was weak because it happened. And so in 2000, in December, I find myself standing in a courtroom in San Jose making a jest. Hollywood is busy suing over the Norwegian 15-year-old, Jan Johansson, who figured out how to break the DVD CSS and to unlock the content on the DVD. And I'm standing in court in San Jose arguing about whether a website in California is entitled to publish what Jan Johansson knows. And I say to the judge, in the presence of Bob Sugarman of Weil Gottschalk, my distinguished opponent of the day, I say, judge, they're telling you it costs them $300 million to create this encryption system, which is so strong that only a child could break it, and a child did. And there is laughter in the court. And the following morning in Norway, Jan Johansson and his father are arrested and criminally prosecuted, and all their computers and communications devices are taken, and Jan's father goes out of business. And I made the joke. And when your lawyer was made a joke, as a result of which people on your side have been arrested and destroyed, you have to take that seriously. But all of that was happening because there were encryption controls. And then Hollywood discovers that it's not going to work. They're not going to be able to keep the stuff on the DVD secret. But it's too late. And they go on, throwing everything. They put everything on the DVD, even when they know they broke it, because they couldn't undo their plans. Their business model depended on it. And you remember, there came to be a company whose job it was to mail, using snail mail, DVDs around. It was called Netflix. And every time they sent a DVD to a subscriber, the movie jumped off the DVD and went into the net. But Netflix didn't care. All it needed was a system in which it could surveil all that watching. Notice that that exactly recapitulates the history of the political economy of information. In the beginning, cheese was sold for money. Then, cheese was given away in return for credit card information, addresses, names, credit records. Then, cheese is just a thing on a mousetrap. While that was happening to the cheese, what was happening to you? Well, you went for people who had unequal access to culture based on where you lived, who you were, how much money you had, to a world in which you had somewhat more equal access to culture, provided that you were prepared to break the law, to a world in which all of that's just cheese on the mousetrap. And you? You have become the mouse. Question? A brief potted history of the political economy of information, 1980 to 2020. Or, how are we going to stop worrying and love being the mouse on the trap taking the cheese? That's a lot of work for a day. There should be some questions. Could you tell us that part again, Eben, when culture didn't used to be on the mousetrap stage? Yes, I can. Actually, the morning before the war in Afghanistan began, I was standing in the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill giving the answer to that talk, right? The first dot communist manifesto, how culture became property and what we're going to do about it. And I gave the talk, and then the following morning at daylight, I drove down the hill from from Chapel Hill to Charlotte, get an airplane bound for California, and in the car I am listening to us beginning successfully to invade Afghanistan. Very exciting. We are now completely out of Afghanistan, sort of. But culture became property, and then it became the cheese on the mousetrap, just like I said.
In what way can you develop on that? Like now, after we have that.
In what way would I?
No, if you can develop on how culture became the.
Well, okay, I mean, now, first I could assign the talk, and, you know, we could do all that, or we could just read the Communist Manifesto. But however we do that, I'm going to have to get all this Marxist stuff on you, right? I mean, maybe you don't want this.
No, I
mean, okay, well, so what happened then? All that was solid melted into air. The chartered freedom to read anonymously vanished and was swallowed by the cash nexus. It became cheaper. In return for less autonomy and more alienation. You can watch anything you want, but you have to let the machine watch you watch it. You can think whatever you want about François Truffaut, but you can't watch him in the dark anymore. When you watch him, it watches you. And try some experiments. Let's see if we can get you to click or swipe. Or would you like a special inside edition on how François Truffaut made the 100 blows? Right? Your relationship to culture change. That's one. Two, that Thomas Edison created industries which made it appear that the purpose of the industry owners was to distribute music or movies or something. But it wasn't. The actual project of the Edisonian industries was a thing called celebrity. That is, artificially large people that other human beings could have a fantasy personal relationship. And the manipulation of that relationship then became the actual purpose of the industry. The consequence of which is, well, depending upon when. In 2000, on my way to listen to the invasion of Afghanistan, I was thinking about somebody called Christina Aguilera. We don't think about Christina Aguilera anymore, we think about Billie Eilish, but... So the question is, what is Christina Aguilera? Is she a musician? Is she a movie star? Is she a prostitute? What is she? Now the answer about Christina Aguilera actually is, she's an incredibly canny musician. But the work to which she puts her musicianship, like the work of another one I might have been thinking about that day, who was Madonna, but she isn't anymore, was to become a thing that there were fantasies about. The end of the conservatorship of Britney Spears is the end of that psychological process. You agree with me? Okay. So that's also what happened when culture became private. Alienation on both sides. The replacement of real relationship by something mediated by the cash nexus. Something solid melting into air, as my friend said. Hence, in 2003, I came along, and we were now deeply into winning the award at Holstein. Remember, it's 2003, everything's great. And me, I go and steal from my co-authors, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, and I make the Communist Manifesto. And what do? I make pastiche. I take a bunch of sentences from 1867 about how culture becomes property and what happens to the chartered freedoms of the workers, and I throw them into the 21st century context. And by God, they were. That was the whole point of the thing for me. It was a literary exercise. I wanted to do something in which I would write using the 19th century sentences about the 21st century substance, and my readers wouldn't be able to tell which sentences were theirs and which were mine, because they would all fit together so nicely. It was a literary work, as I saw it, an ambition for enjambment. Right? All I wanted to do was to shove little things inside Marx and Engels, and it will all read normal. And I thought I had done a very clever job in English, blah, 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 until my German translator really did the job. And I was sitting there reading the German translation, and I was beginning to have trouble because he had so beautifully figured out how to use their German to convey both their ideas and my ideas. And I, too, it wasn't my home language, and I thought, man, I can't tell. That's pretty good. And my comrade, Yochai Benkler, who teaches at Harvard, wrote me in. He said, the first time I read the Communist Manifesto was in Hebrew. So I read it first in my mother tongue, and reading your English, I can't be sure. I thought, yep, it works. But that's because I de-alienated. That was because it was an act of theft. So it didn't hurt it. I just took it. T.S. Eliot was the mentor of that operation. You recall what he said. Good poets borrow. Great poets steal. Property is theft. Well, I'm sorry. I'm now getting even past the Marxist angle. Is that responsive? Well, okay, good, thank you. Nobody else wanted to know, so I'm glad we got that done. Anybody else? Huh. All right. So, political economy produces politics and economy. That's how we began to grow towards the place that we got to in the first decade of the 21st century. Yes?
I do have a question.
I'm glad to hear it.
So I understand what you said, so about culture becoming property, et cetera, and that we had to do a trade-off between keeping autonomy or books being expensive and less accessible. So my question is, what is the way that we could have done to not make books a privilege anymore, to make it accessible to everyone, but without that trade-off?
Okay, so that's my ambition, right? That's what all of this is about, that every brain on earth can learn whatever it wants without regard to the ability to pay or the wings of power, okay? So the question is, how would we do that if we could do it? Well,
yes.
We would make the internet. That's what we did. We made free software. We would create technology, the purpose of which is to achieve that goal. And we would not allow ourselves to be fooled into using technology that is sort of like that, except it achieves some other goal. Right? We have to do the technology, the politics, and the law to achieve what we want. But the king of the undead, not dead. The greatest artist of the second half of the 20th century. The person more responsible for the transformation of the human sensibility than anybody after Pablo Picasso. And that's not what he wants. He's not alone. But compared to him, Mark Zuckerberg is a little thug hanging out at a gas station, selling Lucy's. Compared to him, I mean, really, I have Twitter, I have Groupon, I'm Elizabeth Holmes. The genuine king of the undead is him. And his goal is the subjugation of the human race. An angry, ferocious genius of a little undead child. As natural an example of the pinnacle of the dark undead as Alexander Hamilton himself.
Not that I agree with whatever...
I don't expect you to.
No, not with you, with whatever Steve Jobs did to affect the whole humanity, as you say. But I mean, isn't this going too far in speculating what were his goals?
No, I'm not speculating. I know.
Okay.
speculating. That was the case, and it still is.
But that makes him like an evil monster.
He was. Oh, he was. He was a great artist and a moral monster. That's exactly what he was. That's exactly what he was. Well, we'll have plenty of time. We'll talk about his livers. We'll talk about his apartments. We'll talk about the lawyer whose law license he burned himself, putting her out of work, his general counsel, so he could have 90 days more in stock options. But that's like the CV of Salomon. You don't actually need the CV of Salomon. You just need Salomon. You just need to know who it was. The King of the Undead Now Dead was as pure an example of a certain form as there is. But Percy Shelley, quite a poet, rising above himself, wrote the greatest of all sonnets in the English language not written by William Shakespeare. You remember how it goes? I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless ledges of stone stand in the desert. Near them, in the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well knows passions red which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed it. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Ramses II and Stephen P. Jobs, twins separated at birth by 2,200 years. A Syrian refugee child. Once upon a time, there was a Syrian refugee child from the same part of the south world, of the south of the Syrian world. His name was Yehoshua of Nazareth. And he was the light undead. And he has never died. And then there's the dark one. The hand that mocked him. And the heart that said, no, that was him. That was him. You missed it. You didn't get to see it. But his words went on. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. I made the Jesus. I made the rings of power. And I gave them to men who desired them. That's why I won't touch his name. Because that was the greatness of his sculpture. I know this is not supposed to be true. He's supposed to be an icon of American innovation. And the stuff is cool. It's really cool. And it's evil. It is. If your job is to figure out what technology does to people, iPad, man, that's really good. You want to enslave the human race? You're well on your way. But it has to make the evil beautiful. That is the purpose of a certain kind of art. Remember what Philip Johnson said about why he went to work for Albert Speer and Adolf Hitler running the Nazis Berlin? He said, but the Nazis had all the best graphics. That's the single greatest American architect of his lifetime. And he's an American. A man who wants to possess the ring of power. The beauty of Stephen P. Jobs was that he could suffer everybody from there on down. He puts Albert Einstein's face or Leonard Bernstein's face on a thing. He says, think different. And everybody thinks the same. Because he built the architecture of their thinking. And he made them love what he could build. Now you understand why I really don't want you to write this. Right? That kind of art is a crime in itself. See you in a week.